Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show featuring three different kinds of characters, each of us united, though, in our love of good cinema. The notion of characters, in fact, is on our docket this week as we tackle a pair of films that depend greatly on the respective characters whose story they tell. One is the late televangelist Tammy Faye Baker, who was portrayed by Jessica Chastain in the film The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Then we have the fictional former rodeo star played by Clint Eastwood in his film Cry Macho. Let's begin this week's show by getting into some good old-time religion. In the history of women evangelists, few have stood out more than Tammy Faye Baker. As co-founder of the PTL Club with her husband Jim Baker, she became known as much for her gaudy eye makeup as for her fervent religious fervor. Though she died in 2007, Baker has remained in the public eye through articles, books, stage musicals, and in the 2000 documentary, The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Based on that documentary, co-directed by Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato, Michael Showalter created a narrative film starring Jessica Chastain as Tammy Faye and Andrew Garfield as husband Jim, also starring the likes of Cherry Jones as Tammy Faye's stern mother and Vincent D'Onofrio as evangelist Jerry Falwell Sr. Showalter's film depicts Baker's life from when she was a little girl, hidden away because she was the product of a previous marriage and divorce, through her meeting and marrying the young, ambitious Jim Baker and their historic rise as a popular televangelist couple. While the film dodges some obvious points, it never, for example, successfully explains why Baker adopted her famous eye makeup, much less question why she never asked about her husband's financial chicanery, it does feature an Oscar-grabbing performance by the virtually unrecognizable Chastain.
So here's what we're dealing with in the eyes of Tammy Faye. We have a real-life, larger-than-life character whose experiences sort of played out even in the pre-social media times writ large. Then we have a documentary titled The Eyes of Tammy Faye from 2000 about same person. Then we have this narrative fictionalized, but not really, film, again, called The Eyes of Tammy Faye. So I'm not sure once you navigate this multi-layered sort of approach to the life of Tammy Faye and Jim Baker, that you can really appreciate fully who she is or anything having to do with their lives. Because I thought that this narrative film, despite, Dan, as you point out, the excellent performance by Jessica Chastain, I thought it was a complete waste. And I am not sure why anyone would really want to watch this particular narrative film in lieu of watching the documentary that was made while Tammy Faye Baker was still alive and with her involvement and participation. So I'm going to stake my claim early on and then try to sort of unpack what this film does have to offer, although I'm going to be struggling a little bit to do that. One of the highlights, apart from Jessica Chastain's performance, is an attempt to tell her story from her perspective, but at the same time, we get too much and too little at the same time. So it starts out talking about her childhood and what she had to experience, and Cherry Jones, who also was almost unrecognizable, plays her mother, and we see that, you know, she was raised in this very devout Christian household, and so how she, Tammy Faye, ultimately sort of reconciles her religious beliefs, which I think are sincere, with the whole notion of it's cool to make money, is something that her mother constantly struggles with and reminds her continually throughout the movie. So again, another good performance. But we don't really get enough about what shaped her to become who she was ultimately. And Dan, you've always questioned the fact that, you know, you wanted more information about why the makeup, why the eyes. And the documentary sort of explains that, because she does feel as though the eyes are important. They're the window to the soul. She takes people's glasses and so forth. And that's sort of ignored in the narrative film. Andrew Garfield, fine, not fabulous, but he wasn't given a whole lot to do. Vincent D'Onofrio probably was a real plus in playing the Jimmy Jerry Falwell character. Senior, yeah. we have these fungible evangelists, Jimmy, Jerry,
fungible
Jody,
evangelists.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So
remember
that for the future. So I don't know. I mean, I was looking forward to this film because I do think that Tammy Faye Baker is an intriguing character. But it just missed as far as I was concerned.
I liked The Eyes of Tammy Faye a lot more than you did. I was actually surprised how much I liked it because I've been kind of resistant to these biographical fictional films. I mean, we just talked about a bunch of them last week and the Aretha Franklin film, which I liked less than you did. So I guess it's a switcheroo this week. But I also went into this movie having kind of a fascination with Tammy Faye Baker already because I think she's a much more complex figure than a lot of people realize because she was a caricature and she was a punchline, but she kind of leaned into those in a strange way. It kind of reminds me of how Dolly Parton has kind of navigated her public persona over the years, really just like leaning into how gaudy they are. And she also was kind of excommunicated from the establishment that made her famous in the first place. And it was mostly because of things that her husband did. She was held to a different standard than he was, frankly, after all of that. At the same time,
good news is she didn't go to prison.
That is true. Although she maintained up until her death that she knew nothing about what was going on behind the scenes at PTL or Heritage USA, which was their theme park. And she also claimed that Jim Baker was completely innocent. And I don't think I believe any of that. So that adds to the complexity.
Yeah, she was pretty savvy.
It adds to the complexity. And I think this film, and it has a lot to do with Jessica Chastain's performance. And I was initially hesitant because this is another case of a glamorous Hollywood star putting on facial prosthetics to look like somebody that isn't as glamorous as they are. And I thought she did a really good job embodying Tammy Faye. And I think the movie treats Tammy Faye Baker like a real person. She has doubts about, maybe not about her faith. Her faith is pretty unshakable, but she certainly has doubts about the religion that she's in and about the patriarchal hierarchy of the religion. And she's pushing back both in private and in public against the things that she is allowed to talk about and the things she's not allowed to talk about. She's defying those things on TV. And
okay,
so that's
compelling
to me.
So my question is, if we didn't have the documentary, I think I'd be with you, Nathan, but we do. And so they lift scenes directly from the documentary and recreate them in this narrative film. They also leave out parts of her life.
Yeah.
Nothing about her kids, which, you know, were at least introduced
and
in
nothing,
the documentary.
And nothing about her second marriage to Ro Mester, who's a big star in the narrative film.
Right.
I mean, he's a big presence, he's an important presence.
Well, Ro Mester was one of the lead architects of Heritage USA.
That's right.
And also went to prison for money
bankruptcy
laundering or fraud.
Yeah.
And so that is also kind of tiptoed around. No, I agree with you. I think that in this case, I think the two films, and I don't know how many people have seen the Eyes of Tammy Faye documentary.
Because it's more than 20 years old
now.
Yeah,
it was kind of a minor art house hit, I think, back in the early 2000s. But
RuPaul was great. Puppets.
RuPaul narrated it because RuPaul was friends with Tammy Faye Baker. And that's another aspect of this that's touched on in the Eyes of Tammy Faye just a little bit, is how the gay community embraced Tammy Faye.
Yeah, she became an icon.
She really did. And she treated them like human beings at a time when conservative Christianity they still don't, but they certainly weren't doing it then. So I think that this is a case of the two movies almost working as companion pieces. I think that they sort of enrich one another in a lot of ways.
But, you know, as I pointed out, I think a couple of weeks ago, I was thinking, you know, there was a movie in which I was going, well, you need to see all three of these movies together. And you were pushing back on that a bit. So,
I can't tell you what I would have thought about this movie had I not seen the documentary. Because I've seen the documentary, I can't unsee it. And so I knew a lot of things about her life going in that maybe the movie doesn't explain, and I had those in the back
of my
head.
And so the question is, why doesn't the movie do that? Is it simply because they're trying to reach out to a larger audience? Because there were things in the documentary that seemed to be very important in explaining who this woman was. In fact, she embraced the gay community much more in real life than the movie is.
Yeah, no, it's true. Well, my guess is it's just a case of if you want to include all the details, you're going to have a 3-hour movie. Like, who knows what was in the original script? Who knows what was in the
original outline? Interesting because the documentary's short. I mean, it's like 75, 80
minutes.
Something like that. Yeah.
But so I think I like the companion piece notion that you raised, Dan. So if people want to see the Eyes of Tammy Faye the narrative version, you can still access the Eyes of Tammy Faye documentary. And so I would suggest that you see both of them, each of them.
And regardless of what we're saying here, I think that Jessica Chastain virtually disappears into this role.
Yeah.
This is a fantastic performance. And if, I got to tell you, if Renee Zellweger deserved an Oscar for doing Judy, the Judy Garland story, Jessica Chastain is, this is an Oscar-grabbing role.
Well, and it isn't the case of a performance being good simply because she looks like
Tammy Faye or sounds
like Tammy Faye. She brings an empathy to this performance.
I agree.
I think a lot of coverage of the Bakers didn't have.
Just as Charlize Theron brought a sense of menace to Monster that won her an Academy Award, even though under a lot of makeup, so...
Yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, the Oscars are an eternity away, but maybe they'll remember this one.
And that was our discussion of The Eyes of Tammy Faye. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcast and Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Clint Eastwood's film Cry Macho. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
We say this often, because it's an important fact about public radio. Everything you count on from us. Trusted news, in-depth features, conversations, music, and culture depends on your support. In moments of challenge, possibility, and progress, public radio is a sound, trusted source of information. And that means your participation is more necessary and powerful than ever. Please help SPR meet these momentous times with your generous support, so we can be there for you today and for generations to come. It's easy and secure. Just click the red donate bar at SpokanePublicRadio.org, fill out a brief form, and emerge a new member. You'll be glad you did whenever you turn on your radio. And thanks.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Michael Showalter's film, The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Let's now move to Clint Eastwood's latest effort, Cry Macho. All of us reach a pinnacle in our careers, and this is as true for filmmakers as it is boxers. Former heavyweight champion Larry Holmes should have quit when he was undefeated in 48 bouts, and Clint Eastwood, well, he might still have another great film in him, but Cry Macho isn't it. Based on the 1975 novel of the same name by N. Richard Nash and adapted for the screen by Nick Schenck, Cry Macho focuses on the character of Mike Milo, a former Texas rodeo star and horse trainer played by Eastwood, who is recruited by his former boss, played by Dwight Yoakam, to head south, find the boss's son, Rafo, played by Eduardo Manette, and bring him back north. Seems like a perfect fit for Eastwood, not unlike the gruff character he played in his 2008 film Gran Torino, which also was written by Schenck. But Eastwood is 91 now, and he just doesn't have his former imposing screen presence. Even worse than the clever editing that tries to cover up Eastwood's inability to fight or even ride a horse effectively, the script relies on too many easy coincidences and implausibilities, from the attractive Mexican widow with a pure heart played by Natalia Traven, to timely attacks by the rooster, named, appropriately, Macho, and some fairly pedestrian dialogue. Eastwood has said that he's not finished making movies, but based on Cry Macho, maybe, just maybe, he should reconsider.
Yeah, I think that this screenplay needed another pass through the old typewriter, word processor, whatever it was written on, because the whole movie just kind of feels indifferently made. And I find that really strange because I was reading up on this and Eastwood has been wanting to adapt this novel for something like 30 or 40 years.
Well, the movie began as a screenplay that Nash wrote, and then
he turned it into a novel.
He turned it into a novelization.
Oh.
And then they bid on that. And then when they asked for a screenplay, he gave them the old screenplay and they loved it.
Yeah. I know that Eastwood has been wanting to play this role as well. This movie has been in development so long that he thought he wasn't old enough back in the 80s and he wanted to wait a little bit longer.
Although the character in the novel is 45, not 91.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a slight difference, don't you think?
Yeah.
Minor detail there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just this whole thing, you mentioned contrivance. I agree with you. I mean, the kid in this movie doesn't feel like a real kid. He has all this precocious movie kid dialogue. I never believed him as a real character. And then you have these villains that are going after them. But that whole situation is so sketchy that there's a final confrontation between Eastwood the kid and this drug runner guy. And it lasts about 45 seconds, and then the movie just kind of continues on. And I was thinking, well, what was even the point of having this as a conflict when it's just going to be kind of tossed off like that?
Yeah.
And you mentioned Gran Torino, which is another Eastwood movie about, you know, this gruff, emotionally obstinate man having his worldview changed by a couple of kids. I mean, he's done this a few times. A Perfect World is another movie like that. Going all the way back to Honky Tonk Man, that has a similar kind of conceit. So we've seen him do this material before, and we've seen him do it better. But I wanted to push back a little bit about the idea of him and his screen presence, not having an imposing screen presence anymore, because there's a moment in this movie where I thought, hang on, this is what this movie could have been the whole time. And it's when he and the kid are sleeping in a little chapel, like a roadside chapel that they find, and Eastwood starts talking about the accident that killed his wife and his son, and he gets emotional. It's the first time you see him get emotional about anything in the movie. And I thought, you know, I kind of forget that Clint Eastwood is a really good, effective actor when he wants to be. And I think in that moment...
Or when he's given the chance to be.
When he's given the material to do. Well, he's the one picking the material.
Right. I was about to say, when he gives himself chance. Yeah.
And so I think he does work as a presence in this movie because, frankly, it's interesting to watch a 90-year-old guy direct himself in a movie. And I think that he does a good job, but... As a director, I don't know. There's all these stories about Eastwood being kind of like a one-take director where they'll shoot a scene one time, then he says, that's good enough, let's move on. This feels like a good enough, let's move on, but maybe they should have done a couple more takes of some of these scenes.
I'm going to push back, too, a little on the screen presence because he doesn't have that imposing macho screen presence that he once had.
He's not Harry anymore.
Right. Yeah. And so, but I think that that's good. And I think that they could have played off of that even more. Instead, he's forced into making these sort of half-baked, self-deprecating jokes about his past and so forth. And that didn't really work. But when he does become more authentic in relating to other people or relating to what has happened to him, I think it does work. So now the question is, could he continue to direct, but maybe not place himself front and center? Because what? Gran Torino, I mean, that was what, 12, 13 years ago?
Yeah,
and he should have stopped right there, I think. The Mule was not really
a good
showcase
for
his talents.
I also don't think a very good movie
I think it's
a little better than this.
And look, I want to make a point about my point about the imposing presence on the screen. I think I totally agree with you that he can be vulnerable. But remember the scene in which he's riding a horse?
Yeah.
It was so awkwardly edited. You could tell it wasn't him on the horse. And there's one scene in which he punches a guy, and he can barely get his arm up to do it. So that's what I mean. The old man with no name from the Sergio Leone movies, he's not that guy anymore.
Right.
So an imposing presence can mean many different things. And I agree with you.
Look at
it can be a vulnerable
look
presence.
Look at Anthony Hopkins in The Father. That was, he was still an imposing presence.
Again
because
that's
he
a
was,
different definition of imposing.
Right. But he was still playing his strengths.
Yes, yes.
You know, and
but as being vulnerable. And yeah, both of them can do that. Absolutely.
I also want to talk about the female characters in this movie. The two female characters in this movie.
I was trying to avoid that, honestly.
So, you may recall that Eastwood's last film as a director was Richard Jewell, which was a very flawed, but I think quite interesting
Intriguing movie.
And there was controversy surrounding the portrayal of
the journalist.
A real-life journalist named Kathy Scruggs, who was played by Olivia Wilde in that movie, as some kind of like sex-crazed fraudster. It was just such a bizarre character that I just kept thinking, this is based on a real person? Like, it didn't seem like any real human being that I've ever encountered in the world. Now, in Cry Macho, there's a scene near the beginning of the movie where Eastwood meets the kid's mother, and she's played by an actress named Fernanda Urahola. And the stuff that this movie requires her to do is embarrassing.
It's embarrassing.
The scene that she is in where she comes on to Eastwood and she's clearly trying to, you know, manipulate him so that he doesn't go off looking for the kid, because basically the conceit is that she could lose child support money if that happens.
Property investments.
That whole scene is like cringe inducing.
Yes.
And then later on, you get this other character, the older woman, the widow who runs the the restaurant,
played
the tavern.
Played by Natalia Draven,
Who does a really good job. Yes. She's a great actress. But that's also such a... just a pointless character. And, I just thought, well, Clint Eastwood, just he keeps writing these roles so that women are just throwing themselves at this 91-year-old guy. I mean, I get it. He's Clint Eastwood. But within the movie, he isn't Clint Eastwood. So it's just it's such a strange thing. And I'm not asking that it be totally politically correct, but it is just kind of like, what is going on here?
Mary Pat and I looked at each other and we just said, Woody Allen. Oof, I mean, this is the same thing Woody Allen has been doing for decades.
And the other thing that didn't work really in this film, and maybe it was because of the child actor, but you didn't really get a sense of a connection between these two people. And, you know, we've seen that play out, you know, how people start out in the classic buddy movie or the classic rom-com where people don't like each other and get along, and then it works out in the end.
It happened one night.
Right, but this didn't really flourish in any way because there wasn't any sort of, in my opinion, chemistry between these two characters.
And I don't want to knock the kid, but I didn't think he was a particularly good actor. I also don't think the dialogue helped him very much.
Oh, but I don't know. He becomes a great horseman in about 5 minutes. Can't ride at all.
That's true. So maybe he has a future as a stuntman, not an actor. But
really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when the entire time I was thinking, you know, Clint had better chemistry with Clyde the orangutan than he did with this kid way back in the day. That's probably not a good thing to be thinking
about. You know,
when
the screenplay was running around Hollywood, at one point, Roy Scheider was connected to it. And Roy Scheider, in his 40s or even 50s, could have played this character so well.
That would have been great.
And it would have been a much better movie 30 years
I
ago.
I mean, I think if they were working off of this script as we have it now, I think it would still need retooling.
Oh, yeah.
Because this movie just feels like there's something missing at its center.
That's what I feel, too. It didn't have... It tried to have a heart, but it was, like, artificial. And
it's strange.
But we didn't say... shout out to Macho the Rooster, though.
So, you know, we talked about Jessica Chastain's Oscar chances in the first half of the show. What about Macho's Oscar chances?
Right,
Best Supporting Rooster.
He wins the SPCA award. And that was our discussion of Cry Macho, the Clint Eastwood film. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbender, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you, too, our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the author Darlene Craviotto. Collaborating on a film script involves two people sitting in a room separated by the silence of two minds working together. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.